Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
Good afternoon or good evening, everyone. I'm Mike Wally. I'm a partner with Eisner Amper. We're about a 1,500 person firm in the United States with offices also in the UK, Ireland, Cayman, Singapore, and there's one other, India. We're within the continental US. We're in New York, New Jersey, Philly, Florida, Dallas, Texas, and San Francisco, California. What I want to talk today about is, some accounting strategies for emerging companies and things that, you should have on your radar, whether you're pre-revenue or even revenue, because it's going to impact how you account for things and how you move your business forward, and also how you present yourself as you move toward a raise, a seed raise or a Series A raise. So my slide deck is available. Jed has it. Feel free to circulate it to anyone on the call, and I'll be available obviously after the call. And if you have questions, you can just email me, and I'll see what I can do about getting some time and speaking with you.
And Michael, people may watch this who couldn't make it. This is going to be available to members. They may watch it and contact you.
That's fine. All right, very good. So I have several slides that we'll go through. But as you can see here, it touches a bunch of related topics that, depending on where you are in your business, whether it's startup, pre-revenue, or revenue, and you're looking to expedite it or grow it, there's some of these questions and comments are geared to address those various phases. So the first thing I want to talk about is, really an introspective type of approach is what you should be asking your team or asking of your team also. Because if you recognize that you don't have a full sweat of CFO, CEO, chief technology officer, HR person, you're going to wear many hats. So the first thing you really want to do is make sure that as you look to bring on people onto your team, you look to see if they have multiple skill sets that can offset the cost and actually bridge the gap between where you are now to when you can actually fund, say, bringing on a CFO. But getting more into the details, which really goes back to your budget, but we'll talk about your budget in a slide or two, is you really need to focus on how much it costs to produce, deliver, or support your product or service. You need to factor in what you're going to pay in commissions, fixed salaries, what it's going to cost to develop your product or service, if there's raw materials, labor, coding, depending on if you're a SaaS type of product. One of the areas you need to really focus on is your customer support. Is there an ongoing requirement that you have to be available to your customer, or is it you just deliver your product and the service is complete? The things what we're trying to indicate is, or get across to you is, on the customer support, how much is it really going to cost to deliver and maintain your customer's happiness, so to speak, on your product or your service? The last thing you want to do is have somebody buy something and then call up and get lousy service. You've all experienced that in some fashion or another. The idea is not to have your company be the next one that does that. One of the other areas I want to speak to about is estimating your selling price. It's really kind of finding out what it's going to cost to deliver, and then factoring in all the other costs that it's going to entail that are fixed costs that you're going to incur, whether it's an office lease, insurance, paying your professionals, your attorneys, your accountants for the items that are not necessarily product related. We call them fixed costs, They're going to be there whether you sell one item or 1,000. But you have to factor that in to cover those costs and what we call a break-even point. So if you think of it this way, if it's going to cost you to run your business $100,000, how many units do you have to sell at a certain price point to recover your costs? That's your break-even point. Now you have variable costs, which are ones that are that'll be linear to your product or your service. So if you have a product, it may cost you $100 to create that product, manufacture it. But if you produce 10 items, it only costs you, say, $85. So that at the end of the day, you'll be spreading the cost over a greater number of units. And that is what obviously will help you get to a quicker break-even point. So you really have to understand the cost side of the activity, and then in order to determine what you're pricing. You run into a situation where you say, look, I can only sell it for X because that's what my customers, what the customers are expecting, or my competitors are pricing it. You'd have to figure out, okay, well, how are they doing it? And what are they doing to make it cost effective for them to sell it, because you can't keep selling it at a loss. You'll end up running out of money. Another area that you need to consider is your product or service subject to sales tax. Now understand, sales tax is not a cost that you incur for the most part. It's you are actually charging sales tax, collecting it and remitting it to the taxing jurisdictions. However, if you don't properly account for it and charge sales tax, you as the company who's selling has an obligation to make the states whole to the extent that you have a shortfall. So that can come back to haunt you if you did not properly charge sales tax. An example where you run into problems is if you have a bill for $1,000 and you're in New York State and they charge 8.65%, and you fail to charge the right code, the right tax code, and you only charge, say, 7%, you're going to be obligated to pay the balance. The other side of it is if you just write an invoice and say it's $1,000 and includes sales tax, what the state does is comes in, and I'm sure it's across other states, but New York particularly, they will say you did not properly break out the sales tax on your invoice, therefore you owe us 8.65% on $1,000 and not on $985 for $15 or whatever the calculation would be. So you have to make sure that when you look at your billing, it appropriately includes sales tax. Now that may require you to alter your current web landing page to ensure that that can be plugged in and properly calculated, that the invoices that you're sending to your customers include the appropriate sales tax at the correct rate. So that all has to be factored into what you're doing on the back end. And we find what we have found in the past where that becomes a burden to the software engineers, because they have to go back and rejigger or reconfigure your software to make this work. And it's not necessarily an easy process, depending on what you're coding and how you're coding it. So just factor that in when you're looking to go live with if you're doing a software product, that you have you're able to capture the information. What we're seeing now is companies using a company called Avalara or some other sales tax companies to have a plug into their landing page to allow, Mike Ollie lives in New York State, here's his address, and calculate the appropriate sales tax. It becomes a little bit more complex because, as an example, New York has like 78 different taxing jurisdictions for sales tax. The five boroughs are one tax rate, Long Island's a different one, Westchester is a different one, and as you go to the various other counties within New York, you get a different tax rate, and you could be in a town and you get a little bit higher rate because that's what they're doing. So it's not something you can do personally. You're going to have to factor in the cost of complying with sales tax, which is not an inexpensive software plugin. Now what that plugin will do for you, if you're using Avalara, they will actually capture the information and process and send the prepare the returns for a fee. And then you're wiring the money in to reimburse it. One of the areas that they don't do is actually defend what they do. So you're going to sign an agreement that says we take no responsibility on the actual calculation. We leave that to you. So if you do get audited by the state, you're going to have to defend yourself. So you have to understand what you're signing with these software vendors. They don't want to take any responsibility, but they will tell you that their software works very well. It works very well until you get an audit, and then you have to now demonstrate that you properly charged all your customers the correct sales tax rate. So just understand that software is not, it's a tool, but it's not necessarily a perfect tool in certain situations. Another example of areas where you can really help out is, how can I automate my accounting? What we mean by that is taking your normal activity for the month and having it automated. So using a company software, accounting software such as Xero or QuickBooks to a certain degree, you can integrate it with your bank. So as the transactions come through your bank, it automatically gets uploaded to Xero. And you have a set of rules that says my Verizon bill will always go to telephone. My Gusto bill, which is payroll, will always go to salaries and wages. My sales tax will always go to this particular coding. So you can actually automate a substantial amount of your activity during the month, which will then free you up to really just look at the new vendors that come in or where information is not legible for Xero to read it. So as an example, if you go to your bank statements, they'll have 8 or 10 or 12 digits before that particular transaction. Xero will not be able to differentiate that as being a Verizon bill or a rent bill or anything. So you end up having to manually code that particular transaction. So if you can get 80 to 90% of your transactions, monthly transactions, coded correctly and without you actually having to do anything, that's a great time saver for you. And then you can go look at the activity that hasn't been coded and say, oh yeah, okay, that's an insurance bill, or hey, that's a consultant, and we need to make sure we flag them for, say, a 1099 purpose. These are the areas that can save you a lot of time and energy, along with using the appropriate links from the Shopify or Salesforce.com or any of the other software that are out there that you may utilize to run your business. The other side of that is what controls should you have in place to validate inputs and outputs on the software. So as an example, when you download your file from Shopify to verify what the proceeds came in from your sales, if you're saying doing a software as a service or you're selling goods online, you want to make sure that you have a process in place that you capture that file and be able to save it and find it, because what we see on a lot of these software programs, especially where on the sales side, there's a transaction date and a settlement date. And what that means is you may get a transaction date activity and it may be cut off on, I think it's UTC time, which may not necessarily be when you actually run the report. And you'll have activity that's in process that doesn't show up on the first report you run, and you post that activity, and then the next time you go in, it may not capture it. So you have to be very careful to make sure that the information is being captured correctly and reconcile that. So you need to make sure that somebody knows to go in and what they're looking for to validate the information. If you're matching that up to transactions that are on your website, so that you make sure that whatever you sold, you actually got paid for, well, you have to make sure that there's controls in place to be able to match those up, that information up. If you're selling something with the same dollar amount, you know, as an example, say you're selling razors online and it's, you know, $22 a month subscription agreement, you're getting paid $22 a month. Well, if you have 1,000 customers, how you differentiate my $22 versus Jed's or anybody else? Okay, so you have to make sure that there is a linking between the transaction on your website as it goes to Shopify and then back into your bank account, so that you can track, you know, and ensure that you're capturing all the information correctly. We do see problems with that when we're looking from an audit point of view, and we do focus on those areas where making sure that you are capturing 100% of your activity, and that the reports that you go back 2 months later and you run on Shopify is not different than what you ran today. We've had situations where it's off. It could be off, you know, a few thousand dollars on maybe, you know, $80,000 or $100,000, and you say, okay, well, it's only a few thousand, but if you times it times 12, it can be a number. So what you need to understand how that process works, how to capture the information, and then be able to retain it. One of the other things I want to talk about is your compensation for efforts. We'll talk about that on another slide, but really what you want to do is when you put together your budget, it should reflect when you expect to start being able to get paid at a salary that is commensurate to what the work is being performed. You want to make sure that that's in your budget, because the people who invest in you want to make sure that you can still survive. And it depends on the area that you're in. If you're in New York City, that's a high cost area. If you're in, say, Florida, where it's a lower cost to live there, or you don't have state income tax, there'll be various ranges of which salary you can accept, you want to pay yourself, but there's going to be probably metrics for you to meet. So what we strongly recommend is that in your projections, you show we're going to start paying ourselves when X happens, whether it's we raise $250,000, well, you're probably not going to be able to, you know, pay yourself more than $50,000 each if there's two people, right? Because that's 100 out of the 250 that you're going to spend on them paying for you for a year. So you have to make sure it makes sense on when you will increase your salary or when you start taking salary. One of the other things I suggest is that you have a very strong formal budget for the current year and then for the next year. In our case, and the question is, do you have one? Part of your process of growing your business is really laying out in terms of dollars what it's going to actually cost to run your business. In what I've come across is situations where people go out and raise money, and they have a budget of say $1.2 million, and they're going to have a prototype that's going to be ready to go live. And 10 months in, they spent the $1.2 million, but now they need another $100,000 to get the product to be launched. When you go to your investors, they're going to say, "Well, you told me it was 1.2, so." Your budget really should be a good estimate along with some padding to, you know, ensure for areas where or in expenses that you incur that you may say, oh, I forgot to include it, my D&O insurance, which is $5,000 a year. Well, either you come up to $5,000 yourself and put it into your company, or you're going to have to somehow make a cut somewhere else in your budget that, you know, is probably more needing in terms of getting your product or service to market. So it's really critical that you put together a well thought out budget, because it can come back to haunt you at the worst possible moment when you can't really go back to your investors and say, "Hey, I need another $100,000. They may give it to you or they may not. It depends on where they are. Two things I wanted to bring to your attention relating to accounting. There's a new revenue recognition standard that went live on January 1st, 2019. It's been postponed a year, but it's effectively January 1st, 2020 now. It really is an update to all the previous accounting standards for a lot of industries. They've gone to what they call a five-step model that says, you know, you need to identify who the contract is with a customer, and it may not necessarily be who you think it is. So if you're working for a subcontractor and you're providing, say, software engineering, your customer may be them, or it may be the grant that which they're getting from a governmental agency or a third party. So you may get a different answer on your accounting, but that's usually that's the first step. Second is identifying your performance obligations. What we mean by that is if you have an obligation, as an example, you buy a car, you have a warranty. That warranty is an extended obligation that you now have to take a piece of the transaction price and allocate it to that future performance obligation until it expires. Say it's a 3-year warranty. If there's other areas where you other services that you're performing, saying, hey, we'll offer roadside service within 20 miles of the dealership, then you have to allocate a piece of the price over that warranty or service period. So what this does is it alters the concept that, or the perception that, hey, once they pay me my money, I've earned 100% of that contract amount. That's, under new accounting standards, that's not necessarily true. And it impacts also software as a service. So if you provide opportunities for the customer to upgrade to version 2.0 a year from now at a discount, well, you have to allocate a piece of the current contract price to that particular future performance obligation. If you allow a customer to do anything else that requires you to perform additional steps to earn the revenue, then you have to now take a piece of the price, the contract price, and defer it until such time the service is either performed or the period of time in which that service is available is completed. Once you determine the transaction price, you have to allocate to the various performance obligations, and then which time you recognize the revenue. This is really important for everyone on the phone, because when you go present your information to your future investors or your current investors, it should be under US GAAP, which is what we're talking about here. And if you're providing information that is inconsistent with this, and you actually get to a point where you get audited, you would rather not have to go back and tell them that you were incorrectly accounting for the revenue because you didn't understand what the accounting guidance requires. So this is a good idea, is once you understand what you're looking to do and sell, you probably should be talking to somebody in the accounting field, maybe a CPA firm, to speak to them and understand what your revenue recognition policy should be and how you track it and capture it. Going back to my earlier slide, it's really important that on the back end, you have built into your system the ability to bifurcate information appropriately and be able to use that information and create reports and generate reports that will be supporting of your accounting. This is the hardest part, because most engineers are not looking at it from an accounting point of view. They're simply saying, we capture the information, we put the data, and we move on to the next step within the programming. So just understand that this is something you really need to be speaking to, so that if and when somebody comes up and says, hey, we want to put money in your company, you can be comfortable that your accounting is going to be correct. And they may or may not ask you whether what accounting you're following. And if you say, I don't know, we sell and that's what we earn. Then it's potentially a risk that your revenue will decrease and you'll have deferred revenue. One other accounting standard that's coming up that'll be effective January 1st, 2022, which was deferred for a year earlier this year, is office leases and financing leases, which is your ability to borrow against for capital leases, say equipment or computers, et cetera, or furniture. If you have an office lease, it's no longer treated what they call an off-balance sheet financing. So if you have a multi-year lease, you are now going to put it on your books and records along with a lease liability. They call right to use asset and a lease liability. Generally, it's anything over 1 year, and it, like I indicated, includes office leases. One of the areas that this impacts is your potential covenants. If you are borrowing money from whether it's a bank or a lending facility, or even your investors are giving you notes or credit lines, they may want to make sure that they can get paid back, or you don't go, and if you blow a covenant, then you now have to negotiate it. The reason I'm bringing it up is that it's something that's going to happen in the near future, and you need to make sure that if you're borrowing money, that none of the covenants are going to be impacted when you put a lease liability for a 5 or 10 year office lease on your books, and all of a sudden your covenant is in violation, and now you have to go back to your lending partner and ask for money back, or ask for a waiver, which they're going to charge you a fair amount of money for. And one of the areas where people were trying to think about getting around putting the leases on and saying, I'll have a 1-year lease and I'll just have it renew every year, the accounting standards, they took that into consideration and said, hey, if you know that you're going to renew that lease, you need to make an estimate on how many years you're going to renew that lease and account for it from that point of view. So they've gone out in a way to make sure that people do not circumvent the accounting rules. Switching gears a little bit to Series and Series A financing. On your capitalization table, you have what's called pre and post financing calculations. The question is ultimately who gets diluted? You have your founders, then you have your friends and family. You may have some safe notes or kiss notes out there. I put a link to Brian Axelrod's article back from 2014, which I think mathematically spells out the calculation and who ultimately gets diluted. So if you conceptually, you're starting out, you and your founder are starting out 50-50 or 100% between the two of you. You're going to sell 30% of your company for a $10 million or $20 million valuation. At the end of the day, you're going to end up with less than 50% each. They're going to end up with 25% of the company. And the balance will end up getting diluted to anybody else. So while you may come in at say a friends and family and you own 5% of the company now, after the financing transaction, you're not going to own 5%. You may end up owning 0.5%. So ultimately, when that new company comes in and investors come in, somebody has to have money or percentage ownership taken away from them. So this article really spells out how you should understand the mathematics of it. When you sit down with your attorneys, they'll tell you all the legal aspects of it. But here's a situation where it's really important that you understand what you're signing. You can have friends and family who will be really upset that all of a sudden, hey, I don't have 5% of the company anymore. I'm now down to 0.5%. That's not what I got involved in. So it really comes down to understanding who's going to get diluted, because ultimately you're going to have to answer to them. It's important to understand how the proceeds will be paid out, whether it's upfront or milestone based, and are linked to a deliverable. So you may get a seed round where it says we're going to put $2 million into your company and you get 100% of the proceeds. You may get another one where it says, look, we're going to put $2 million in, but we'll only put $500,000 when you hit a certain milestone. And once that milestone is hit, then we consider putting the next round in. This goes back to my earlier comment that if you run out of money before that milestone, it's highly unlikely they can put more money into your company. And then they're going to say you have to go out and find alternative sources to make up the difference, get the milestone met, and then we'll consider putting more money into your company. So again, going back to being very competent approach to preparing your budgets is really, really important. Another area about the Series A and C financing, really need to understand your term sheet for existing arrangements. And these include the conversion features that are built into most of these arrangements. There's typically four that give rise to different accounting. Down round, which is effectively, if you are priced at a dollar and then you go out and do another round that's below a dollar, the other investors who are being diluted will end up saying, hey, we need to maintain our existing number of shares. So they have protection, price protection effectively on the number of shares. A capital lock is used to determine how many shares will actually be issued upon a conversion. The discount on the next qualified round, typically it's about 25% on a safe note from what I'm seeing in the last 6 months or a kiss note. However, understand that 25% will give you off the next round, but you'll still ultimately get a lower number of shares because the calculation will mean it's got to come out of somebody's pool, and it's going to come out most likely of the safe note and the friends and family. Most favored nation clause is primarily whoever has the best deal, they get the same deal. you don't see that as often, but the first three are fairly prevalent in a lot of these arrangements. Last is to consider, just from your perspective, are these future investors the right fit? So questions you may should be asking is, you know, look, is this $2 million will get me from A to B, but how much access or contact will I have to the investor group? Is it going to be once a month, once a quarter? Will I be meeting the person I'm talking to right now, or I'm going to talk to their second in command or the junior in, person that just joined the firm 3 months ago? It's really important that you understand the level and the ability to speak with them and bounce up questions and ideas to offer them. And where are you in your financial knowledge, right? Because if you're looking for them to help fill out certain areas within your or blind spots, and they may look and say, well, we thought you understood this, okay? What are the reporting requirements, both from a financial and operational? Going back to having good books and records is having current timely information. And if you don't have information that you have to now put together for, say, a September 1st delivery for your July numbers, and you haven't even reconciled February or March, that creates a potential problem because you're going to be spending the weekend trying to put it together, and invariably you're going to have mistakes. And you're going to be presenting board packages and things of that nature, and they're going to want certain specific KPIs or financial or even operational information that is not necessarily easy to accumulate when you're trying to run a business, you know, during the week. Another area is that they're going to come back and say a portion of your shares that you own are subject to risk. What they call them is restricted shares. So you may end up on day one getting 1 million shares. You go out and do an equity raise. They're going to say, we need to have you put 500,000 of your shares that you currently own as restricted shares that are subject that if you leave before a certain period of time, you lose these shares. So you really should understand what you're giving up and what is your risk. Whether you're speaking to your attorneys or your accountants, you really need to have that conversation to understand what it truly means to you as the owner of the company. Okay, in terms of payroll and withholding related matters, one of the big issues that we've come across is compliance with the Fair Labor Standards Act. So technically, as an owner of a C Corp, you are an officer, as opposed to being a member in an LLC. The distinction being is, one is you have to get W-2 wages because you're an officer. As a member, you are an owner, not an employee. And you do not have to get paid wages. You get the benefits of your company at the end of the year, whether you have income or loss, it's attributable to you. Under federal law, if you have more than a 20% or greater ownership of the equity shares, you're exempt from having to get paid a minimum wage. However, state law does not necessarily have that exemption in all 50 states. So what that means is, regardless of whether you meet the criteria for federal, you are obligated to pay minimum wage to everybody, offices included, minimum wage. So what came out of this is you created a company, a C Corp, you have two partners, you and yourself and the next person. Somewhere along the line, that person leaves, and in speaking to an attorney, a labor attorney, they say, hey, you know what, you were not paid minimum wage, and under the state law, Massachusetts, New York, or whichever, you're entitled to compensation, and they come back and say, you failed to pay me. And now you have litigation and other issues that you now have to deal with, which is going to cost you a lot of money, either through paying attorneys or payments to get make the person go away. And you know it's going to be around an equity raise as opposed to when you're almost out of money. Okay, so one of the things is to pay yourself a minimum wage, whether it's $10, $13, or $50, whatever, particular to your state. Pay it, and you at least avoid the risk that them of a former colleague of yours coming back and suing you for not paying the the sweat equity per se. I've included a link from Invigor Law, which kind of walks you through one of the states. And it's helpful to just try and understand what you need to be doing. I would have to say 99% of the companies that I've been working with in over the last 5 or 10 years were not paying themselves payroll until they went out and raised money. So there are at risk for one of their colleagues to leave and then come back and sue for not paying a minimum wage. But just understand that this is something that is out there. Also understand that options or shares is not compensation for the Fair Labor Standards Act. So you can you may get shares, but it's from their point of view, it's not appropriate. You have to pay cash. So just factor that in. You can still pay minimum wage and then issue shares or options. That's perfectly fine, but you still need to pay the minimum wage. Another topic I'd like to just touch upon is the preparing a sound budget. So I have a bunch of bullet points on here, and I want to be respectful of everybody's time. But the idea is that it's a tool, not a concept. You need to post realistic costs. If you think that your directors and officers insurance is going to be $500, you're probably going to be woefully underfunded for that. It's probably more like $2,000 or $3,000. And if you add that up to other transactions and vendors and et cetera, and other costs, you end up having a budget that's not realistic. We also recommend that concurrent with that, that your reporting, financial reporting should be current or must be current. A, it helps out in terms of when you go out and raise money, they're gonna say, can you give us some financial information? You don't want to have to tell them in August that the last piece of information that you have is dated December 31, 2019. Okay, you want to be able to say, I have something through June, which is reasonable, or July 31, that would be awesome. Okay, because then it shows that you are on top of what's going on. Your information is relevant and it's current. In terms of budgets, we recommend that they are monthly budgets along with an actual column next to it. Remember, the budget is a projection, and you want to make sure that you have compared to actual. The actual is really a mechanism to identify where you made decisions to spend money because of certain events or certain situations, or you reevaluated where you want to put the most bang for your buck, so to speak. We always recommend the 3-year cash flow for your projections. You know, year one should be definitely monthly for 2020. Year two and three can be quarterly, although we recommend it's monthly with a summary into quarterly. A, it allows your information to be readable and legible and understandable on a slide deck. And you can do year date, you know, so if you did through June and then you have July and August, and then you have the rest of the year and the quarter is next year. It'll show where you're gonna expect to spend the money, when you're gonna make, when you're gonna generate revenue, and ultimately when you think you're going to be cash flow positive and also positive in income. You also need to consider when you need to have additional funds. It's a great spot to put in, hey, this is where we're going to have a shortfall, where we're going to need to raise money. And it also needs to include any CapEx. So if your company is dependent upon having servers, computers, et cetera, where you have to spend money upfront, you really need to focus on what it's going to cost for your employees to deliver the services to your customers. Cash flow should correlate to when the specific milestones are expected to be reached. Again, that ties into how much money you need to get to your particular milestone or to market. And again, factoring in some additional costs or maybe not being approaching it from a low estimate of what it's going to cost to do it, give a little bit extra cushion, so to speak, in the numbers to be reflective that if you have a mistake in there, it's not going to be egregious in terms of being short cash. Always helpful to have a sensitivity table in your projections that you can speak to, that if sales increase by 25%, our cost of services should not increase by 25%. There should be some economies of scale, and help show that the economies of scale will be there, and also what it will impact your ability to get to break even or generating positive cash flow. I always suggest that your projections should offer multiple paths to revenue, not just a single, one solution. So you may have a main path which you want to articulate to your investors, but say, we have this one is the one we're going with. Choice B and C and D are on the back burner because we think there's markets available or opportunities in markets that we can exploit. However, this is the one we're going to invest in currently. You may end up switching that based on conversations with them, but at least you are showing that you're thinking about it other than, one opportunity. We also recommend that you have a base model, which is what you're effectively going out off of. A best and a worst case scenario. What happens if you're not generating revenue? Then you have to cut back on costs. Best case, if we're hitting our targets or hitting them really well, then we're going to expedite the following costs to hire people to ramp up production and contracts and revenue. What this does is it demonstrates your understanding of the risks associated with each path, and it gives a little bit more insight for you to understand what you have in your numbers, so that if somebody asks you questions, you don't want to have to say, hey, I'll get back to you. You can say, oh, okay, I'm familiar enough with my numbers and the content that I can speak to you about it on a one-on-one conversation. It also will help articulate your cash burn and also be able for you to identify what assumptions are used in your projections. If they say, hey, what does this mean here? You can say, we considered the following assumptions in quarter, three of 2021, where we believe we need to spend X amount of dollars on headcount and or support. Your projections really should be realistic versus a bootstrap approach. The reason I say that is it's not a question of how well you can get everything done on the lowest amount of cash spent. It's what I'm going to invest in your company. I need to know what it's going to cost for me to deliver, to invest in your company to meet your targeted. If your budget is weak or omits a lot of costs and expenditures, what's going to end up happening is you're going to come back a year later and you're not going to be hitting any of your numbers, maybe the revenue, but your costs are going to be out of control. And you're not going to be able to explain why, other than going back and saying, you know what, we never considered X or Y or Z. So really get involved in your projections and understand them, and they need to be truly realistic. Last comment is you need to, once you expect to be profitable, you need to have a tax cost built in, because that's the corporate piece that is an obligation on part of the company. The change in tax law for federal is 21% for corporations. Depending on which state you're in, it could be as high as another 10 or 12%. So what we recommend is somewhere between 28 and 30% should be your input for taxes when you are profitable. That's a reasonable number we see in a multitude of industries and even for valuations and projections. So it's a reasonable number. And it at least recognizes, depending on where you are, the your obligation. Obviously, if you're in Florida, you're only going to have 21% for federal. So my last slide on today's topics is really maintaining your accounting ledgers. There's two primary software out there, Xero and QuickBooks. QuickBooks is, to a certain extent, a dinosaur. They do have, they've gotten better in terms of interacting with the other software vendors. However, it's still an antiquated software package. Xero is much more flexible. From a cost perspective, they're about the same based on the number of transactions. From an introductory level, they're about $18 a month. One of the downsides of anything that's off the cloud right now is If you don't back up your data, you lose it when you terminate your relationship with any vendor. So we strongly recommend that you do backups regularly. Make sure that it's not just to your laptop, and if your laptop gets lost, stolen, or damaged, you cannot access any of the information, or at least you lost any information from a backup standpoint. So use the cloud. Make sure if it's on your laptop and the cloud, you're fine. You at least have two spots for it to be found. As a business, as opposed to you as an individual, you need to retain copies of invoices, contracts, et cetera, expense reports, copies of bank statements that are now electronic. You may need to go in and electronically download them every month. After 6 months, generally, if you want a copy of your bank statement from a business point of view, and even potentially as an individual, they will charge you by the page for something that you should have just downloaded timely and saved. So it's important that you keep all these financial records, both from a tax point of view and also from a point of having to go back and look at something, the information is available, rather than waiting for the banks to open or information to become available after you pay for it again. Maintaining permanent files. We talked a little bit about contracts, lease arrangements, employment agreements, your formation of your company, your articles of incorporation, your bylaws, your minutes of the company. All should be maintained in a permanent file section. When you're going to do due diligence with a Series A or seed money, or even somebody who's seriously going to put some safe notes into your company, you want to have it all available that you can open up a data room and have them grab this information and download it, rather than you say, hey, I have to go back to our accounting firm to get our tax return. I have to go back to the attorneys to get ours with the corporation. And it takes you 2 or 3 weeks to track this down. Or worse, it's something embedded in an email that you may not have a copy of going back a year and a half ago. If you're granting any equity instruments, you need to have them in writing and keep a signed copy of them. A lot of times I see it'll say executed on the top, but there'll be no signature on the form. So just please make sure that you retain executed copies of things you're signing. Copies of your 83B elections and any 409A evaluations should be maintained. Again, going back to the service providers or your vendors or consultants, and asking for information from them. They may not have it, or they thought you had it. We've seen that time and time again. From a financial reporting point of view, capturing your financial information on the platform, both the front end and the back end, whether it's changes to agreements, you know, the service level agreements that you're using for, whether it's Shopify or Stripe or Gusto or Salesforce. I've had a situation where a client had a contract with Apple and they couldn't find it. They had to go back to Apple to ask them to give them a copy of the signed agreement. Apple did provide it to them, but it took like 4 months to get it. So we ended up having to hold off on our audit for 4 months until they got that final piece of information, because they were a significant customer. So making sure you have copies of your executed agreements is really important, especially when you're going to do a due diligence. You may have people who come and work for you. They're responsible for executing some agreements or contractual arrangements with your, whether it's Amazon Cloud or any of your other software vendors, and you find out they quit and it's buried in an email that you now are going to have a fun time trying to find. It's really, really important that you maintain appropriate controls and processes to ensure that, you know, you're not going to go back and try and find it from somebody else. I mentioned earlier on is reconciling your revenue to third-party payment vendors, whether it's Shopify or Stripe, along with if you're using Avalara to do your sales tax, you need to make sure that all that information makes sense and that the amount of revenue that you think you generated off your platform is rectified and reconciled to these third-party vendors to ensure that you have completeness. So just a couple quick slides. For from an accounting and an audit and tax standpoint. The firm is offering what we call an abrupt service, where we provide in a bundled fashion your corporate returns, availability to talk to us about general questions and provide questions and answers, looking at your financial information, assisting you toward getting GAAP financial compliant so that the information you're providing to your investors are reasonably accurate and within the appropriate guidance, accounting guidance, access to whether it's myself in our technology practice or getting access to our tax partners, or whether it's a sales tax issue or jurisdictional issue. If you're here in New York and you're looking to open up an office in California or have a presence in California, what does that mean? So we put together this package, and it's really primarily two things. It's geared toward companies that are at the point of view where they're looking to raise money. They want to make sure they're getting everything lined up and in order. And then we can help you in now rather than 2 months from now, or 3 months from now, trying to go back and then do a retrospective look and try and get things cleaned up. The idea is get in now, get things in order so that when you're raising money, this is one issue that is off the table. We're putting it together. Each company will be priced accordingly, because some companies will have transactions of 20 per month and others will have 200 per week. So it is somewhat volume based, and it also depends on, you know, when you need financial information.
Great. I don't have a lot of experience using the way it's set up in terms of webinar. Usually I just do a regular Zoom meeting, so I don't know if you can raise your hands. Does anybody have questions? If not, see if you can raise your hand, or feel free to put a question in the chat box. I have a question, so I'll start with it. You talked about that corporations, founders of corporations, shareholders need to be employees, I think.
Yes.
Okay. So if you're a founder and you're not, and you're just doing work and you're not a W-2, is that a problem? Because it's very, very common that you don't pay yourself when you're just creating a new company and you kind of brag about it even.
So it's not an issue if there's one founder in the company. You're not going to sue yourself, right?
Right.
It's only when you have multiple people within the founding organization and somebody leaves and they come back and they sue and say, hey, I wasn't paid for all the sweat equity I put in, then you have a legal situation. As I pointed out, there's an exception for federal law of if you're more than a 20% owner, you don't have to pay yourself. But if you have multiple investors, or at least founders, you may have somebody that is below the 20%, but you still have to comply with state law. And not every state agrees with the federal view of not paying somebody.
Okay. Is there some states where if you're a sole founder, you need to pay yourself because of, you have to pay Social Security and Medicare to yourself, even though you're a sole founder? Nobody's going to sue you, but you have to pay that out yourself.
So if you're the only individual, they can't force you to pay, right? Because you can make a decision not to pay yourself. Okay. But it's only when you have somebody who you have multiple investors or multiple founders that you run the risk that if somebody leaves, they can always come back and sue you for not paying the minimum wage. So okay. By paying the minimum wage, you prevent anybody from coming back with a legal argument that says, you know, I didn't get paid anything. And you say, well, everybody got paid minimum wage, so therefore we're compliant with the labor laws, and you have no argument. So if you don't pay yourself, you don't pay yourself. But here's the point I want to stress. I had a company in New York City. New York City comes in, even if you're not paying yourself, you still have to pay into workers' comp and unemployment, regardless of whether you pay a dime to yourself or not. And it's a nuisance situation, but it's an easy way for them to just come in and club you over the head with an invoice. So you have a triple problem. You have state disability, workers' comp, and unemployment. And all these state and city agencies operate differently than, say, the federal government in terms of FICA and Social Security, and also, you know, health insurance, et cetera. So these are the little things that come back to haunt you 2 years from now, or even 6 months from now. And as an example, if there's only one person, well, and you don't pay yourself, your only obligation really is for the workers' comp or disability, okay? But I've seen a situation where a company was challenged by New York City workers' comp, and they, because they were using, or they were involved in using an MRI machine, they were classified as being high risk because of the close proximity to the device, as versus say a sedentary, and they were basically hit with a $4,400 bill or something of that nature, that they basically put the company out of business because they said, look, we're not going to pay New York City $4,400 annually for the sake of just being in business. So understand you're not going to win that argument, but that's where situations like that do arise. And usually it happens when you file your first payroll run return and the state says, when did you begin formed and when did you begin doing business in the state? And when you start paying people, they will come back and say, hey, what about this period in the intervening period when you were doing business in New York to when you actually started paying people? And that's when these nuisance taxes pop up out of nowhere. And each state and each jurisdiction has their own little nuances. So I'm just pointing out to you that you have to be very careful on this. You know, if you don't pay yourself, that's fine. Just understand that you have a risk that somebody can come back and claim that they weren't paid, and then, you know, you have to pay them to go away.
Okay. No, it's good to know that the IRS won't come after you if you don't pay yourself for Medicare and Social Security. It's only, that issue is only about other people, Medicare and Social Security.
Generally, yes. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Next question is from Suresh. Can sweat equity be counted as expense or contribution to the company?
No. So if you were to, the only way to do that would be is to put a liability on your books for accrued compensation that hasn't been paid. And as soon as you go to raise money, they'll say, well, that's just sweat equity. We're not going to pay you for the last year and a half of you not working. That's on you. We're only going to pay you going forward. So regardless, it's an entry that will never ever be paid.
Okay. Any other questions? We're a little bit over, but if we can field them, one more question, if anybody has one. So it's August, so I assume there's going to be a lot of. This is very useful for members, so it will be available for in recording. So if you're listening and recording, feel free to reach out to Michael. With any questions you have, just give them some contacts that I saw you on a DEF recording, and feel free to reach out, and you can always request the deck from myself or from Michael.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deaf.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deaf.org/join. That's def.org/join.